rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Greg Judin ist Professor für Soziologie und politische Philosophie in Moskau. Er unterrichtet an der Hochschule für Sozialwissenschaften und Ökonomie in der russischen Hauptstadt. Judin ist eine prominente Stimme aus Moskau, wenn es um die Interpretation der dramatischen Veränderungen geht, die das Putin-Regime im eigenen Land und in Europa bewirkt. Bei Protesten gegen den Krieg wurde er nach Medienberichten von der Polizei bewusstlos geschlagen und musste in medizinische Behandlung. Ende April war Greg Judin zu Gast in Wien. Er sieht eine Zeitenwende mit dem Angriffskrieg gegen die Ukraine. Der Buchstabe Z, der zum Symbol für Russlands Krieg ist, ist für ihn faschistische Ästhetik, die an das Hakenkreuz der Nazis erinnert. Die Säuberungen im Inneren Russlands und der Krieg bedeuten für Judin, dass die schwere Krise Europas erst am Anfang steht. In Wien hat Professor Judin seine Antworten auf die Frage versucht, warum? Warum hat Putin diesen Krieg begonnen? Der Soziologe war in Wien Gast des Osteuropa-Think-Tanks IKÖR. Er ist einverstanden, dass wir seine Aussagen im Falterradio übertragen. Die Veranstaltungssprache war Englisch. Wie faschistisch ist die Richtung, in die sich Putins Regime entwickelt? Das ist eine der Kernfragen, die Greg Judin behandelt.
The fascism question. Well, I must tell you, I was trying to avoid this label for a long while. For a very simple reason, because it is used basically often is it used as an insult. Well, if you want to insult someone, tell them they're fascists, and that kind of inflates the use. So I was kind of, I mean, if people call each other fascists, that is no longer a strict concept, and it becomes useless. That's why I was kind of reluctant to use it for Russia, but. The theoretical reason for that was that, well, basically there were some elements of a fascist regime there. I agree with that. We were aware that some of the members of Russian League were admirers of Mussolini. That's also true. It was obviously a right-wing regime. Also true. But there was no fascist mobilization there. And that, to me at least, that was important. And this is exactly what we're seeing now. This is why I'm now no longer cautious. I'm now saying that it might be a real, real fascist turn. There was no fascist. It was a demobilized society, depoliticized society. People were not into politics. Now we're seeing elements of a very strong mobilization. I think it makes, I mean, it even feels like a huge difference. People are starting to think, well, if I'm not reporting on someone, probably I will be reported on. And that kind of makes you, it no longer leaves you in this passive position of a bystander, of a spectator. No, you no longer have right to be a spectator. You have to act proactively. To me, at least, in terms of like political dynamic, it makes a lot of difference. Even though I agree with you that there were already elements of a fascist regime in place before that. I also would like to use this opportunity to make a brief comment on the left-right issue, on the communist issue. Because, I mean, I agree with you completely that the Communist Party, all the way along, of course, the Communist Party of Russian Federation was an extreme right-wing party. I agree with the whole rubber stamp character of Russian parliament, but if we speak of ideology, there was extreme right. Has nothing to do with the left. And one of the interesting tendencies in Russia recently was that because of its name, it was actually a cohort of young activists who are really left-wing. And of course, I mean, as any kind of genuine left-wing activists, of course, they're opposed to the government. And there was an obvious split within the Communist Party. It became obvious in 2021. Actually, it started to consist of two very, very different currents, which are very, 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 not so much in common. And I think that was one of the reasons why this operation was so necessary, because not only the opposition was kind of emerging, it was already visible within one of those parties, and it gained a lot of ground in cities like. In big cities, basically, Moscow, Novosibirsk, Yekaterinburg, to some extent. So basically, the Communist Party was taking like, real ground among those left-wing people. So obviously, this is a right-wing regime.
Die russische Öffentlichkeit war auf den Angriff gegen die Ukraine total unvorbereitet, sagt der Moskauer Soziologe Greg Yudin. Schock, Angst und Anspannung sind die Folge.
Total unpreparedness, which I think was intentional. And resulted in a significant shock, which in turn created a lot of anxiety and fear in Russia. And if you ask me to describe the atmosphere in Russia right now, I would say yes, it's anxiety, fear, tension.
Meinungsumfragen sagen in Kriegssituationen nicht viel aus, argumentiert Yudin. Mehrheitlich folgt die russische Bevölkerung der Argumentation der Führung, wonach der Angriff gerechtfertigt war. Trotzdem geht eine Spaltung durch das Land. Vor allem junge Menschen sind skeptisch gegenüber der offiziellen Propaganda. Je länger der Krieg dauert, desto größer wird dieser Bruch zwischen den Generationen, sagt der Soziologe.
As the war goes on, looks like this generation gap is getting even stronger. So the younger people, they are even more skeptical about this military operation. Basically, they understand the price for them. Whereas the older generation is more supportive. Well, I would say probably because of rising fear.
In der Kriegssituation verändert sich der Charakter des Kreml-Regimes, analysiert der Moskauer Soziologe Greg Yudin. Aus einer autoritär regierenden Führung wird immer mehr ein totalitäres System.
There is this difference between the authoritarian and totalitarian regimes. You know, authoritarian regimes, they are relying on public passivity, on people being passive and disengaged from politics. In an authoritarian regime like Russian, for instance, for many years, you were free to think whatever you want, believe whatever you want, and even to say whatever you want. Well, with some reservations, but still. Now this common sense no longer works. Many people perceive it as they have to be proactive. They have to act. Otherwise, they might become legitimate targets for repressions. That results in ideological pressure, mainly in educational institutions, because, of course, this is where the young people can be found. And everywhere we have those lectures, even in kindergartens, I mean, there's lectures basically hammering Putin's version of Russian history into children's heads. And they are tested to make sure that they have now one similar homogeneous vision of history. This is not authoritarian. This is different. But I think many of you saw those things and those Z signs, which are clearly reminding of something again from Germany. And even more important, I think, the persistent tendency to make those Z signs from human bodies, particularly from children's bodies, when little children are standing on their knees in the kindergarten, making the Z signs from their bodies. So this use of human bodies for these symbols, well, it's obviously a fascist aesthetic, a fascist perception.
Für den Moskauer Soziologen Greg Judin sind Kriegsverbrechen und Massaker wie in Butscha auch eine Folge der neuen Ideologie des Putin-Regimes, von der notwendigen Säuberung der Bevölkerung von russlandfeindlichem Gedankengut und von Trägern russlandfeindlicher Ideen.
Perhaps the most dangerous thing, I think, is this new ideology, and was clearly an ideological turn in mid-February. I think it was 3 days before the war when Vladimir Putin was giving his speech about the history of Ukraine. And this is where when he first consistently used this idea of this idea of denazification, of attaining purity. It's basically, Ukraine has to be purified, purged. Well, already then it was clear how dangerous this concept is, because I mean, if Ukrainians, at first it is like we have to topple the government, we have to get rid of this Nazi government, that would be denazification. But then what happens if Ukrainians start resisting? The only conclusion you can come to is that turns out things are worse. We didn't expect them to be Nazis. All of them are Nazis, actually. We have to purify Ukraine, to separate, to decompose it into two elements. One of them is clean, which is basically Russian because there are no Ukrainians. Ukrainian-ness doesn't exist. And the other one is Ukrainian Nazi component. This is dirt. It has to be removed. So for that reason, to be honest, I was not surprised by those terrible events in places like Bucha, because that's the only logic that can be driving those events. What I think also very worrying is the growing identification with the leader, because it, of course, leads us to the famous triad. The leader is the state, is the people. Some of the elements were already present. There is this well-known saying from Vyacheslav Volodin that if there's no Putin, there's no Russia, which basically identifies the country with the leader. So now I think there's this growing identification with the leader, unfortunately, among the people who were previously passive. I don't like that because it means that people start saying, well, we shouldn't have started this thing in the first place, but now that we are in it, we have to take it to the end, because otherwise we're lost. Russia will not exist anymore. And that kind of creates preconditions for general mobilization. People were saying that, well, probably general mobilization would be unacceptable for Putin at this point, politically. Now, unfortunately, I think the situation might be changing gradually. So if it goes like this, there's definitely already a sort of reframing, attempts of reframing the whole thing into a great patriotic war, a continuation of the war that we've been fighting against the Nazis back in the 40s, right-wing regime.
Greg Judin erlebt die Kriegspropaganda in Russland als eine Rhetorik, die weit über die Ukraine hinausgeht. Die Ukrainer sind in Putins Geschichtsbild ja kein eigenes Volk. Der Angriff auf das Nachbarland wird als erster Schritt eines um vieles weitergehenden Krieges in Anlehnung an den großen Vaterländischen Krieg gegen Hitler-Deutschland gesehen, so Judin. Ich habe ihn gefragt, was er genau meint, wenn er sagt, dass in der Putin-Propaganda der Ukraine-Krieg nur ein Anfang ist.
This is not a war that Putin is waging in Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't even exist. There are no Ukraine, there's no Ukraine and no Ukrainians. You cannot wage a war on somebody who doesn't even exist. This is a war against NATO, the West, the Americans, those words are used interchangeably. It was, I mean, the narrative is very, very consistent about that, never denying that. And that is, I think, basic to understand the vision, if we have to understand the vision of Russian leadership. This is definitely a war NATO. I mean, today, in the same statement from the Ministry of Defense, they went as far as saying this is the war against the whole planet. It's not me, it's them. Looks like, again, we are in a war against everyone. This is what they said today. By again, they mean World War II. It actually brings to the question of the narrative about World War II. It has changed significantly. So today, in this statement, they said basically, once again, we are fighting the whole Europe in a war against Nazis, which is consistent with the narrative they were building for several years, that basically the Great Patriotic War was a war between Russians and a united bloc of Americans, Germans, English, French, Austrians. I mean, all of them, they were against us. And we defeated them. And now we'll do that again. So this is definitely not a war against Ukraine. And the general aim of this war is to change the global order. And this is why it is worth the risks, the stakes. This is why it is worth putting at stake everything this system has achieved, including its prosperity, resources, everything. We have to win big in this war to change the global order. So the war in Ukraine is only the first stage of this big attempt at changing the global order. Now, as for the military aims in Ukraine, they can be defined as military control over Ukraine. I think it follows from what I mentioned about the vision of Ukraine as a threat. So as long as there is no military control over Ukraine, Ukraine becomes an existential threat. I know. After those initial setbacks in this military operation, some people think, well, probably the aims are limited. First of all, today they already made it more significant. The plan announced today already means annexation of part of Moldova. It made it open finally. They have not given up on the idea to seize Kyiv, because that would secure the military control over Ukraine. Ukraine cannot be a sovereign state. Now, the specific solutions, I think, can be negotiated. It is partitioned, it retains its formal sovereignty, but it cannot be really a sovereign country. It has to be under military control of Russia. And once again, this is the first step. Now, what would be the dynamic of that, as you're asking? I think the calculation is it's not just my thoughts. I think Russian ideologists are saying it clearly. The calculation is that once we go further to the west, for instance, Poland, and you remember this ultimatum which meant already the removal of all NATO troops from former Eastern Europe, from former countries of Warsaw Pact. Now, if we go to Poland, no one is going to fight for Poland. French already failed to fight for Poland in 1939. Why would they do that again? Particularly if they face a nuclear threat. Why would Germans fight over Poland? Poland is so far away. So, and they say that this very clearly, that Article 5 of NATO treaty is not going to work. And once it fails to work, NATO is de facto dissolved, of course. Because the day it fails to work, NATO is dissolved. And they're very, very clear that they believe that it's not going to work. Now, That means, of course, that the stakes must be as high as possible. And in Russian nuclear doctrine, we have first the idea that the use of nuclear power is justified when there is an existential threat for Russia. And this situation is already defined as an existential threat. Because the Russian leadership identifies itself with the country, so it says it is already an existential threat. So in theory, we're already in the domain when this can be justified. They also have this idea of escalate to de-escalate in their nuclear doctrine. So they have the idea of escalate to de-escalate, which basically means that we will blackmail you until you give up. This is what they mean by escalate to de-escalate. I think we are heading towards some sort of nuclear crisis. I'm not sure it will happen shortly. It could be some sort of like ceasefires, but as long as this leadership is in power, I just cannot see them giving up.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
On that, because this is a very consistent vision. Now the question of humiliation. I wouldn't expect actually too much logic or consistency here. This is emotional, and I think this is important to understand about Russia, because this is really, really widespread. This feeling of being humiliated, not respected, is really widespread. There's not so many points where Russian presidents is really in contact with Russian people. Because people are generally estranged. I mean, they're not big admirers of the Russian president. But on this point, there is a close contact. It is true. Russians feel humiliated, not respected. And I don't feel like it can be alleviated with some sort of like show of respect. It just went almost paranoid. I cannot see, I mean, like if we ask what can be offered to alleviate this feeling, I don't feel like there can be any answer to that. Honestly, I mean, it's not even discussed in Russia. Like, what kind of respect? What kind of respect are we demanding? It just drives this resentment further and further. They don't respect us. We need respect. And I think this is also clear in the wording of Russian government. It keeps saying, well, we told you, you didn't listen to us. You do not respect us. You don't recognize our demands. If you do not recognize our demands, we will basically destroy you. It's sort of threatening with that. So, yes, and I think it justifies this military campaign. And those connections that I've mentioned, are actually perceived as a sign of a weakness of the West. Yet another belief is that the West is morally weak. So basically, if we have those connections, it doesn't mean that they kind of respect us, that they're doing business with us. No, they're just afraid of us. They're weak. They're weak, and therefore this is probably a ground to humiliate them. I mean, honestly, the narrative is really brutal here, and not in the area of compromise.
Even among young people.
No, among young people it's different. Among young people that's a good question. Among young people it's different. It also lands there to a certain extent, but to far lesser extent. So among the young people, they are more. I mean, they feel more like part of the global community. They are included in cultural flows of communication. I mean, they feel like they're part of international community. And so parts of that, it lands with them, but I think not genuinely. So that there is this difference, yes. And now about the victims. I think it is mixed. First of all, of course, the victims are not made public. They published in something about, if I understand correctly, the question correctly, it was about the soldiers who, yes. The Russian soldiers. So they would publish it in local newspapers. This is how people learn about that. And there are actually some news agencies collecting those news from the local papers, because that's the only way you can collect the data. Most of that is still not published. The selection of soldiers was skillful, because it was drafting people from ethnic minorities, depressive regions, countryside, and therefore those are people who are less resourceful and less likely to complain about that. I mean, there are limits to this strategy, of course, but there is this significant skew. But as long as those killed in action, the number of those killed in action, prisoners, becomes higher and higher, I think we have this shift of narrative, which basically reframes the whole thing as a patriotic war. And then, I mean, when people ask me how many dead soldiers do Russia need to understand this, my answer is 27 million. Because that was the number we had in the Great Patriotic War. I mean, if it goes full way until recognizing it as a patriotic war, as existential threat to Russia, then it would be a very different order of magnitude for casualties.
Die russische Gesellschaft nimmt nach der Diagnose von Greg Judin so ziemlich alles hin, was von oben kommt. Aber damit sei Russland gar nicht alleine in der Welt. Putins Regime ist Teil einer internationalen Entwicklung gegen die Demokratie.
The idea that the atomized society results in the absence of political nation. I mean, I share it there very much. There is a lack of political subjectivity. And when people ask me, like, what Russian society thinks or does or wants, I say, well, there's basically, if you speak of Russian society as a political subject, there's no Russian society. Once again, the common sense is that you have to mind your own private business. Don't care about what happens around you. But that shouldn't be interpreted so as to say that, well, there is something inherently wrong with the Russians. I've brought this comparisons precisely to demonstrate how the analysis shows us that it is not necessarily something about Russians. Under some historical circumstances, that can happen to various nations, particularly to those who used to be empires. Not limited to them, but particularly to those who used to be empires. So I don't believe it to be a problem of Russians, to be honest. Well, there is, of course, a whole layer of the problem with the Russians, with the political responsibility that Russians are not willing to take. And this I think, is a matter to discuss seriously, because when you are kind of giving up on politics, you assume that you have no political responsibility, which is not true, of course. You're just ignoring it. But having said that, I want to say that I don't see it as a problem with the Russians in the first place. I mean, this regime, we are now called fascist or whatever we call it, it is deeply entrenched in global finance, global economy, global politics. And Putin has been taking roots throughout Europe for a long time, has very well-established connections with the financial elites and then with the political elites all over Europe and basically all over the world. I mean, François Fillon and Gerhard Schröder, they are not Russians, as far as I'm concerned. And that this is a larger problem. This is a problem with how political systems work. Indeed, the Russian case is an extreme case of this dominance of economy of the polities, of this lack of political control of a big money, of a corrupt money. That's true. But we see its connections, and these connections are now playing themselves out. I mean, in countries struggling with how to deal with Russia, like Austria, for instance. Now we see the price of those connections. So I don't see it as a problem with the Russians. But I agree with you, General. Now, the question about the secret opinion polls. This is a standard question. Let me tell you a big secret. Those polling agencies, they have to conduct their interviews. So people who are literally conducting the interviews are interviewers, no matter if they do it by phone or face-to-face interviews. So those call-in centers or those agencies who are actually doing the field work, they are the same for all those independent agencies. So basically, they come up with the same numbers, and that's not by accident, because they're using the same technology and even the same subcontractors. Those secret opinion polls, they do not differ. Even in theory, they could not yield different numbers. They're doing the same stuff, if they are doing it correctly, which we actually often doubt. So the whole idea that there are some secret polls showing different information is a matter of people in the government trying to bring each other in delusion. They're playing with those numbers. They are selling those histories and those theories to their leadership. This is why they need those secret polls. Yet another thing I think I have to emphasize is that those secret polls conducted by the security services, they are good because they need not publish them. So they can have some picture without making it public. That makes sense in terms of governing with polls. But if they have completely different numbers, then these are most likely wrong numbers. So if the numbers are correct, they have the same numbers. But once again, I emphasized already that we have to be very, very careful about those numbers. And I'm not sure the people in the government are careful about those numbers, because they kind of, you know, first you kind of create this atmosphere of fear inside the society, then you take a poll, then you look at those people answering your polls, being scared, and then you say, well, probably Russians want war. But come on, it is you who wants war. You make the Russians reflect your attitudes. Very interesting question on opinion polls in Crimea and those small statelets. Just recently, Washington Post published numbers from the poll Germans were taking, the Institute in Berlin, Zeus, was taken together with American colleagues. And they were polling in January, so before the war. They were polling in those regions, in Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts. I wouldn't go into detail, but one interesting thing is that depending on where the call was from, and then they were also doing in partnership with Levada Center from Moscow. So depending on where the call came from, the results were completely different, like completely different. Which kind of supports my argument that for the respondents, it matters who asks, who is asking. Depending on who is asking, you will give your answer. That, I think, tells a lot about the validity of those polls. And I would also like to add that I'm very, very skeptical about the polls taken in Ukraine. Show overwhelming support for the president, for Ukraine. I mean, it's a country in war. What do you expect from these people? They have martial law there. What do you expect these people to tell you? So I don't like, I kind of feel like everyone understands why opinion polls in Ukraine have to be taken very cautiously, but people somehow forget about that when I'm talking about Russia. But Russia is also, I mean, no matter what the leadership thinks, Russia is also at war, obviously. And people understand that, even they're not willing to admit that. Now the fascism question. I must tell you, I was trying to avoid this label for a long while, for a very simple reason, because it is used basically, often is it used as an insult. If you want to insult someone, tell them they're fascists. And that kind of inflates the use. So I was kind of, I mean, if people call each other fascists, that is no longer a strict concept, and it becomes useless. That's why I was kind of reluctant to use it for Russia. But the theoretical reason for that was that, basically, there were some elements of a fascist regime there. I agree with that. We were aware that some of the members of Russian League were admirers of Mussolini. That's also true. It was obviously a right-wing regime. Also true. There was no fascist mobilization there. And that, to me at least, that was important. And this is exactly what we're seeing now. This is why I'm now no longer cautious. I'm now saying that it might be a real, real fascist turn. There was no fascist. It was a demobilized society, depoliticized society. People were not into politics. Now we're seeing elements of a very strong mobilization. I think it makes, I mean, it even feels like a huge difference. People are starting to think, well, if I'm not reporting on someone, probably I will be reported on. And that kind of makes you, it no longer leaves you in this passive position of a bystander, of a spectator. No, you no longer have right to be a spectator. You have to act proactively. To me, at least, in terms of like political dynamic, it makes a lot of difference. Even though I agree with you that there were already elements of a fascist regime in place before that. I also would like to use this opportunity to make a brief comment on the left-right issue, on the communist issue. Because, I mean, I agree with you completely that the Communist Party, all the way along, of course, the Communist Party of Russian Federation was an extreme right-wing party. I agree with the whole rubber stamp character of Russian parliament, but if we speak of ideology, there was extreme right. Has nothing to do with the left. And one of the interesting tendencies in Russia recently was that because of its name, it was actually a cohort of young activists who are really left-wing. And of course, I mean, as any kind of genuine left-wing activists, of course, they're opposed to the government. And there was an obvious split within the Communist Party. It became obvious in 2021. Actually, it started to consist of two very, very different currents, which are very, very, very not so much in common. And I think that was one of the reasons why this operation was so necessary. Because not only the opposition was kind of emerging, it was already visible within one of those parties, and it gained a lot of ground in cities like in big cities, basically Moscow, Novosibirsk, Yekaterinburg to some extent. So basically, the Communist Party was taking like real ground among those left-wing people. So obviously, this is a right-wing regime. I agree with you.
Wie sich Putins System der Bespitzelung von jedem gegen jeden und der damit eingehenden Säuberungen auf die Erziehung der Jugend auswirkt und was von den Gerüchten über gesundheitliche Probleme des Präsidenten zu halten ist, wird der Moskauer Professor gefragt.
The health question. I'm not an insider. I have no idea what's going on there. We had this investigation a couple of weeks ago by journalists from Project Media, who were tracking the doctors who were traveling with Putin, and they were able to find out that lately there were oncologists and endocrinologists traveling with him. I mean, it tells something. I don't know exactly what. But honestly, I don't think it's a solution. I realize many people are kind of thinking of that, but I don't think this is a solution, not because there will be someone instead of him. I think if actually somehow Putin is removed, the whole system collapses, just because it has invested too much in one specific figure. It is impossible to replace this figure. The charisma is not transferred. But I'm rather worried about what comes next, because if this project is aborted, then there will be yet another attempt to resurrect it. So I don't want this to happen. The role of corruption, I think it's huge. And I actually mentioned that. I mean, we were talking so long about corruption in Russia, but look, it turns out that the whole Europe can be bribed. The whole Europe can be bought. So I think that also makes me think that this is not a Russian problem. It's not about Russian being specifically corrupt. No, I mean, Putin knows how things run, not only in Russia, but elsewhere. He knows how greedy people can be. He knows that, and he uses that. So I think, taking on corruption is a key task, but it's not limited to Russia. The final question was about the effects on education. I mentioned that, I guess, during the talk, that yes, obviously, there is a strong pressure on people who are teaching. They face those they face those even criminal charges. I mean, I think we already have two criminal cases against the teachers because they were reported on by their pupils, and so now they face like real prison sentence. I agree with you that generally Putin and people around him were very skeptical about intellectuals. They never liked the educated class, and they always acted against this class, both in terms of their policy in education and also in terms of their cultural policy. They don't really believe in the idea of critical education. They kind of think, well, that what you need education for is either to make weapons or to have a propaganda. Otherwise, not clear. But still, the parts of educated elite were able to sustain a niche within those systems up to this February. And actually, the money were coming into the system on the condition that people kind of publish something in the international journals. They were paid for that, even like cynically, almost like a sales manager. You publish something and you get a whole lot of dough for that. You publish nothing, you're not paid. So they were able to do that. But now even that is basically destroyed. Partly because of those boycotts, but also partly because the whole cultural idea makes no sense any longer. I mean, what is the point in being integrated into this global community if we are kind of breaking all the ties of this community? So I think it's quite predictable that intellectuals, educated people, people in science and education become the primary targets here. It's quite predictable. And they are, of course, the people who are most embedded in global community. And, of course, they feel like what is going on is hurting them directly.
Greg Judin tritt mit überraschender Offenheit und mit einem scharfen, kritischen Blick auf die russische Gesellschaft an die Öffentlichkeit. Ob er, der Bürger Moskaus, nicht Sorge um seine persönliche Sicherheit hat, wird er gefragt.
Honestly, I'm not saying now anything that I was not saying publicly. you're free to share the information. I'm honestly puzzled when people are asking this question about fear or danger. Because the way I see it is that we're actually heading to a very, very dangerous moment. And by us, I don't mean only Russians, because Russians are suffering a lot of already. But I mean at least us Europeans, and probably even more. I mean, I'm serious. We are heading, perhaps, there is a high chance, given the logic of these people, what they have already done, we're heading towards a very, very serious crisis. So probably we have to do something about that. This is why I don't see Vienna as a much safer place than Moscow. I mean, to a certain extent it is, of course, but this is precisely what I would like people to understand, that it is not about Ukraine. It is not about Kharkiv. It is not about opposition in Russia being crushed. It is far beyond that. The way it evolved, when Russians were out on the streets protesting against this regime, there were several waves of that. And remember that the last wave was just in 2021. It was the most significant in terms of both numbers and the cities participating, which means actually that Russians are looking for any opportunity to perhaps to seize the moment. There's a lot of potential there, which is difficult to understand. So every time Russians were out on the streets, they learned that there are new lucrative contracts for Putin and his elite. He has struck a new gas deal or an oil deal, and that of course created this feeling of despair, of hopelessness. I mean, what can you do? No one is supposed to help us. But at the very least, perhaps, not investing so much money. Now we know that Nokia was behind those new surveillance systems installed in Russia to spy on the people who are trying to resist that. And Finland is now joining NATO over the threat from Putin. Is it logical? So I'm just mentioning to show that basically this was happening for a long time. It happened to Russians first. Then it happened in 2020 to Belarusians, where obviously with Putin's backing, there was this brutal crackdown on the protests, with many people dying. And now we have this in Ukraine, with even more people dying. Why should we assume that it is going to stop there? It never stopped. I mean, what would it take a U-turn and turn into a peaceful liberal democracy? So I think we are really endangered. And that's why I think, it is high time to take action about that. Now about sanctions. For a while there was this logic of like, let's impose some sanctions to create some incentives for Russians to revolt. This is not how it works. And I even doubt that it could work with Austrians as well. Because basically, if you're presented with this choice between your motherland and, sausages, what would you choose? And obviously, if Russians are presented with this choice, it only kind of increases their resentment. Fortunately, I feel like there's been a change in logic recently, and probably I'm wrong. but or maybe I'm wrong. But it looks like now it is no longer the education measures. We'd like to educate Russians, which obviously creates a lot of additional resentment. But it is kind of defensive measures, which makes more sense, because we're no longer doing that to kind of educate you, because we are aged people, and you are just little kids. It sounds more like the defensive measures, which I think makes sense, but I wouldn't expect it to incite action immediately. What I think is possible to do with I mean, what could be the outcome of those sanctions, like looking at those who kind of imposing, looking from the perspective of those who are imposing those sanctions. The whole edifice is kind of relying on this belief in Putin's omnipotence. Basically, if he wants something, he will get it, no matter what. If you can call it charisma. If it is disrupted in some way, if people like start feeling, well, probably things are not running according to the plan, he's not in total control, well, that might make some people reconsider. So that might be the effect. I think, like, speaking of embargo, I think that this is also a way to think about that, if it will cause like some disruption. But I hope I make it sufficiently clear that, of course, I don't want Russia to be completely kicked out from those supply chains or from energy deals. Because, I mean, Russia, of course, is a country with a lot of natural resources. It has to play its role in this green change. I mean, obviously, and there's a lot of people in Russia who understand that. We wouldn't want to be eliminated. It's just this government that is doing everything to do that. So I really, really hope that those measures, I mean, it's not up to me to decide whether they are whether they should be enforced, but I really hope that Austria or other European countries can look behind this government and look at Russia as a reliable partner. Because that's my country. And I want it to be a reliable partner, of course. I don't want it to use energy deals as a tool for blackmailing the partners. This is crazy. I don't want this to happen. And, of course, a lot of people in Russia wouldn't want this to happen. And they are now closely watching what is going on to see if they are relied on by potential European partners. I understand it's a difficult situation, but Russia is not its government, no matter how much the government wants it to be. Now the U.S. threat, is it a real issue? I don't think so. I mean, I think even now with this administration, the U.S. made it clear that they're not going to engage in this war. And I think it's not a real issue. Obviously, from the perspective of the U.S., it's a proxy war. Now that they have this strong rising opponent, it would be better to fight it with Ukrainian hands. It's a classic proxy war. I think you're completely right on the color revolutions issue, because it was always the problem for Putin. This is precisely the recoding of internal into external. There cannot be such thing as a genuine revolution. It's just impossible. It never happened. It never happens, because the people cannot be a subject. If you start from those premises, then obviously any sort of revolution would be actually a war waged by the external opponents. So that's the problem. that this leadership doesn't believe in genuine popular action. That's why they hate Lenin, for instance. Because Lenin is disruption, is popular action. And of course, if you see things this way, you start being paranoid about color revolutions being everywhere. And those revolutions being staged from the outside. So the genuine popular element is completely disregarded, it's completely ignored, and some support from democratic countries is amplified. And this is the picture you have. So I think you're completely right on that. About the older generations, they certainly remember what purification means and what Stalinist purges mean. But they also learned a lesson under Stalin. And the lesson is actually keep silent. And you'd better report on someone. Because if you report on someone, the chances are lower that you will be reported on. I'm exaggerating now a little bit. But fear normally kind of drives people to those conclusions. And I hear it from the elderly people. They say, well, you're young. You don't really remember what was going on here. We learned our lesson. Please stay silent. Please don't speak up. Is the fear of color revolution shared? I think somehow mixed with this sense of humiliation, it partially is, because it is also, when it is framed as an attack from the outside, this lands well with the Russians. Otherwise, I mean, there's no general. Well, once again, because the society is atomized, the whole idea of a general popular action is, people are very skeptical towards that. I mean, if there's someone on the streets, they are definitely paid for that. And that happens again and again. I mean, those police officers, they arrest people on the streets and they keep asking them, tell me who exactly and how much paid to you. And they are completely, and it makes no sense to disagree with that. They know that you were paid for that. They know it for sure. And I think it is widespread in some parts of the population, at least. So there is just this strong disbelief in any kind of collective action. But otherwise, I mean, revolution, if it's against the rich, why not?
Sie hörten die alarmierenden Ausführungen des Moskauer Soziologen Greg Judin in Wien bei einem Seminar des Wiener Osteuropa-Thinktanks IKÖR unter der Diskussionsleitung von Christoph Bilban vom 22. April 2022. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Im Falter gibt es ausführliche Berichte aus der Ukraine und über den Ukraine-Krieg. Ein Abonnement des Falter können Sie im Internet bestellen über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik des Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.